No,
I didn't realize. I guess it's out there. I just hadn't paid enough attention. Joe Berger's going to hang it up after this year.
Yeah, he was it Gessling that did a piece on him, or maybe he just talked to him in the locker room today. But I saw some quotes from Gessling's Twitter
apparently
account.
Apparently, he considered not playing this year, and now he's happy he came back.
Well, he's got, I think him and his wife adopted a bunch of kids. He's got about 75 kids or something like that,
oh,
too.
Really? I know. So yeah. he's a help humanity type guy.
Absolutely, yeah. Okay. But what a great story. I mean, was he an undrafted guy or a late-round pick from Michigan Tech or wherever the heck he played?
I think he was like a late round pick.
But what a great story, man. I root
so
for guys like that.
He's playing right guard again now, right?
Yes, yes,
now
sir.
Now we got Remmers playing left guard.
Yep,
right?
That's the plan.
And it's already out there now that the Vikings are going to take an offensive tackle in the draft.
How about the
Mel's
oh
fantasy?
My God.
Mel's is this number one? Is this one?
I think it's 1.0. Yeah, I think it's 1.0.
1.0. We got a. We're picking 31st.
That's
so
the controversy, by the way.
He has the Vikings losing to the Patriots in the. So we're not getting any respect if we play the Patriots in the World Series.
There was a Jacksonville fan that retweeted it and said, "Already got us losing. We don't get any respect."
Well, him and the rest of the world, buddy.
Although, what if Brady doesn't play with the broken hand?
Well, yeah. Well, then what a battle it would be. You know, are they if the Vikings beat the Eagles without Wentz and the Patriots without Brady, do we get an asterisk?
I think we might have to.
It's kind of like Roger Maris's home run record. Are we going to get an asterisk?
And nearly two games against the Packers without Rodgers.
Yeah.
And winning the Super Bowl at home.
Right.
Yeah, right. I don't think it's going to count. I don't think we can really count.
I already see your tweets coming.
I think I'm going to let up. They're so damn sensitive.
I know.
You can't. I mean, this is as crazy as it's ever been. I mean, I sent out a perfectly reasonable tweet that everybody went nuts about, and they all want me to no longer live.
Because you've got our defense mechanisms up, Patrick. That's
okay,
what you do.
And that's why I'm going to give you this prediction right now, because it's my last time on the air before the game, and this is not any kind of trolling. This is nothing. Vikings 27-10,
boy.
I firmly believe it. I firmly believe that they're going to kick their ass. They're going to move the ball against that weak secondary, but with those two receivers catching 8-yard passes, and they're going to move the ball, and Philadelphia is going to have to come out of their shell and try to do some things. And Case Keenum, while he certainly was flawed in the second half against New Orleans, is not nearly as flawed as Nick Foles, in my opinion.
I think they're
going to whop them.
I do think that one thing that will help your cause, sorry, Manny, is that it's going to be 50 degrees on game day. And it's not going to be, 28 with howling winds at game time. I think that does play to the Vikings' advantage.
The only way they can lose is if they turn it over three times.
Yes.
If they get out to a 17-0 lead like they did on Sunday in New Orleans, it's over. The Eagles will be done.
Yeah.
Because they do not have the quarterback. I mean, they've got, Alshon Jeffery's pretty good, and Aguilar's pretty good, but
Ertz.
They do not have the quarterback.
And,
yeah, Zach Ertz is good, but they don't have the quarterback
and
that
by
can
the way,
fling them back into a game.
Manny, for the only time in this postseason, you saw the Vikings pucker because they were at home, and they all of a sudden they felt the pressure. When the Saints started that comeback, all of a sudden they puckered up. Playing at home, all of a sudden it's going to end right here. Now they made the play at the end, fantastic, but the way they played in the second half, they lost their composure pretty one of the few times you've seen it this year.
They started to melt down,
and they won't I the pressure's off now. I mean, it's not completely off, because you certainly feel like you should beat the Eagle, right? But they won't play as poorly again in this postseason as they played.
Well,
the
you're not going up against Drew Brees either.
Second half on Sunday. No,
right. Yeah.
No, that's what I'm saying.
But you know what? And the other thing, too, is Manny said if they get out to a big lead like that, well, the one thing that could happen, too, is if you get a 10-point lead at any point. That's what I think is key. But getting them in three and outs, that defense for the Eagles then will get wore out because they'll be on the field a lot with that offense not being able to move the ball against
and
the Vikings.
They Vikings don't let you, you know, the Vikings opponents let you throw those little dump passes against, you know, over the middle to Thielen and Diggs. Not little ones, but, you know, the 7-8 yarders. But the Vikings don't give those up with the linebackers right. they have. They don't give those up. They don't give Foles that soft little area where he can, knows he can throw the ball and get a first down.
They're going to put 9 in the box and make Nick Foles beat him because they know that the running game is their key.
I think the biggest key in the game is going to be the Vikings offensive line. Can they give, because that Philadelphia front seven is pretty good. That defensive line, they've got some depth there, and they've got some pass
Chris
rushers.
Chris Long, and they got their number one draft choice.
Brandon Graham's really good off the edge, and Fletcher Cox is he's just a monster. So if they can protect Case Keenum and give him some time and keep him out of those 3rd and 15 pressure, you know, where Jim Schwartz can maybe dial up a blitz or two, if they can keep Case Keenum out of that, then I think the Vikings will be fine.
Yeah, that I agree with you is the only thing. By the way, I saw, where did I see the stat today from, I didn't realize how often Keenum had been pressured this year. We're talking about the offensive line just because it's so much better than last year.
Yeah.
But did I read it in one of Collar's pieces or something? They've still been pressured like the 6th most in the league or something like that.
It's just Keenum's ability. Keenum has the mobility to sort of move around in the pocket and he'll tuck and run if he needs to, and Bradford never did that.
No. Well, and so maybe they got a break when Bradford got hurt. People don't believe that. I do get a kick out of people talking about, well, you know, sure, they're playing without the Packers are playing without Rodgers, and the and, you know, sure, Philadelphia's playing without Wentz, but we're playing without our starting quarterback too. Yeah, but you might be playing your best quarterback for the way you're trying to play, right?
Mm-hmm.
Keenum. So anyway, I think the Vikings win 27-10. And don't call me up about jinxing you. What do you want me to say? That I don't think they're going to win?
Yes.
Yeah, because then you're being super negative. Yeah. Then you're just being Ricey, typical Ricey being negative.
How about this?
Oh. They win. They're the better team by a significant margin.
How about this quote from Brian Hoyer? We were talking about Tom Brady with the injured hand and maybe the chance that he might not play. Brian Hoyer from ProFootballTalk.com, quote, "If I don't play, then that's really good for our team."
What are they up to? It's not like they're going to convince Jacksonville to prepare for somebody else at quarterback.
You
what
know this is
to?
Just Belichick having fun with everybody else because that's just what he loves to do.
Hey, by the way, great piece on SA.com. A huge, long piece. Some gal who I'm not sure who she is, but she's pretty good. On SA.com today, SI.com. On this relationship between Belichick and Saban, and how far back?
Oh, I only saw the tweet. I didn't read the article.
Oh, it's got to be 150 inches long.
Did she get quotes from them? How'd she get them to talk?
Yeah, they were both fairly cooperative. Yeah, I mean they weren't, you know, they were fine. I got a hunch that it's something that maybe had been worked on
for a while,
couple of months.
Sure,
and it fell right for them. But they're big buddies, and that's why they both treat the press so kindly. We'll be back with Kevin Seifert.
Talking Purple right now on The Ride with Royce.
Kevin Seifert from ESPN.
It's Kevin Seifert.
Here with Kevin Seifert.
We have ESPN's Kevin Seifert.
It's ESPN.com's NFL Nation reporter, Kevin Seifert, presented by Mystic Lake.
Kevin Seifert is with us. Kevin, I was reading that long piece on Saban and Belichick, it is interesting how these two guys go back to the Naval Academy connection and became buddies. It's not hard to fathom those two guys as good pals for the secretive kind of obstinate ways that they have.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to argue against that secret, obstinate ways, given their relative success. I think that's the worst takeaway from that great story that Jenny Brentis did over on MMQB, was that and that the whole relationship started when they were each working for different teams, and they had to secretly, I mean, the NFL secrets go way back. They had to secretly drive to a third-party, undisclosed third-party location with like 16-millimeter video scavenged in the back seat to go meet and talk ball at a time when they were technically competitors. And really fascinating to see how the two best coaches of this generation and maybe beyond have sort of run parallel lives and interacted with each other in so many different spots.
It is amazing. Belichick has to win one more to equal Saban's national championships. I mean, Belichick's won 5, Saban's won 6 in college football, which is incomprehensible, that's for sure. Although I think if I had to deal with one of those two guys, I think I'd rather deal with Belichick than Saban. I think Saban is much more condescending. Belichick is just, you know, he just wants it to get over with. But
From an immediate perspective, Saban's more volatile and accusatory, and you get these lectures that you really don't get from Belichick. You just get indifference.
That's right. Hey, I also, it didn't strike me. I guess it should have. I was reading a Shermer thing today. He was Chip Kelly's offensive coordinator and obviously was looking for a job after Kelly left and Peterson came. But I wonder what a Chip Kelly offensive coordinator does, A, because that's his whole deal, but that might be one of the reasons the Vikings are playing with this pace that they hadn't played with previously. Maybe Shermer learned something from Kelly about playing at a faster pace.
There's no doubt, and I think he's even acknowledged that he incorporated, you know, he comes from the Andy Reid tree.
Sure.
And the West Coast type offense, but he has been very open, and people who watch the coaches film are very much convinced that he's incorporated parts of the Chip Kelly offense into what he does. And that was a huge, I think, driving point for his popularity throughout this whole interview process, was that he had sort of done the magic sauce, which is not be wedded to one particular scheme or one particular way of going about things, but being open-minded to the point where if you encounter something that could work, you incorporate it and don't worry about copyrights, and you take the best of all of it and put it together into the game plan for the 11 guys you're going to have on the field for that particular game. So, you know, he might use more Chip Kelly offense with Case Keenum as the quarterback than he might have with Sam Bradford, for instance. And I don't know if that's true, but that's the type of sort of fungible coaching and scheming that NFL teams are desperate for, and really is the key to the survival of any unestablished head coach. You don't have time to come in and overhaul the roster to get the exact type of players that you need to fit into the scheme that you want to run. You have to meld that scheme with the people you have already and the people you get in that first year, or you're not going to make it.
This is completely off the track here, but you bring that up and how coaches and quarterbacks are both on the short, 2-3 years, baby, you're gone. What is the latest Mike Brown letting Marvin Lewis come back? I've always said that he's a guy that just from a distance, if you tell him what he has to do, he's not going to do it. But this time, even Marvin thought he was going to do it. What could be the possible explanation for Marvin coming back again?
Well, you have to start with whether they're being run competently, to be honest with you. I mean, that's the first part. You know, does Mike Brown have a good reason for that? And that's not to impugn the coaching abilities of Marvin Lewis, which we've seen, and the sort of CEO abilities he has, which have come through in the fact that they're now much more professionally run on a relative scale than they were when he got there. But I don't know that you could come up with a good reason other than fearing change and wondering if the next person to come along is going to want to do things differently than the way you're used to and not wanting to change those things and feeling that you have the right structure in there and that if, you know, certain injury things go the right way, you could turn it around. But beyond all of that, if I were a Bengals fan, I would be concerned about whether good, honest, unsentimental decisions were being made in the operation of the franchise.
Yeah, it's they don't spend any money. They have the worst facility that there is, and they're going the way of the Oakland Raiders here, while Oakland's heading off to Vegas. I don't see how the Eagles win this game unless the Vikings turn it over a bunch.
Yeah, I mean, I was just talking to somebody else, and on paper, the Vikings defense is much better than the Eagles offense. The thing that the Eagles got going a little bit against the Falcons was this short, you know, passing game and then run, or Jay Ajayi breaking tackles and getting down the field. And the one thing that the Vikings defense, even the other day, was still really good at and probably the best in the league is tackling. I mean, you don't get extra yards against them.
Yep.
And so if the Eagles' plan is to come in, or their hope is to come in and get rid of the ball quick and have their receivers run away from the Vikings' defense, that is not a good matchup for them. So they're going to have to figure out something entirely different to get to the point that they, you know, whether it's how many points they need to score to beat them. Is it 20? Is it 25? They need to score 30. The Eagles' defense is pretty good, and they're opportunistic, and they could score some on their own. But if the Vikings play a relatively competent offensive game and they get to maybe 20 points, or that might be it. That might be all they need.
I was going to say, if the Eagles have to score more than 20, I don't see it happening.
Yeah, yeah. And so that's a nice, you know, round number to cut off at and say, like, it's not even at best. It wasn't, you know, that explosive of an offense last week against the Falcons. They figure out how to get things done. But that might not be enough this week, given how the Vikings offense has played this year.
That was we were just talking about it a minute ago, though. That was a rattled football team, the Vikings, in the second half. But I think that's past them now. I don't think you'll see them play again like they played in the second half Sunday.
Yeah, they definitely had a combination of mistakes happening one after another in a way that almost always leads to a loss. I mean, you know, let's call it what it is. They should have lost the game. You know, it was a great play that they made at the lowest percentage possible to win it. And so when you throw an interception and get a punt blocked and you know, get beat on fourth and 10 and all those sorts of things, those are the things that get you beat in playoff games. And if they do that kind of thing in a close game in Philadelphia, they could potentially lose again. So maybe they look at it and say that, you know, in the grand scheme, that they weathered a storm that the Saints put on and that they have the confidence that they can do it. But I wouldn't test it. You know, that they do something like that in that series in that short period of time in the second half against Philadelphia, they could very well lose that game.
Kevin, it's amazing, and I've talked to you about it, the way people are completely paranoid about protecting the football now, not throwing interceptions, certainly not losing fumbles, as compared to a couple of generations ago. I was looking up the 1980 Vikings playoff game in Philadelphia. And Tommy Kramer threw five picks that day, and the Vikings were still in the game. Late third quarter, into the fourth, they threw five interceptions.
Yeah, and the closest modern comparison, wasn't it the Brian Hoyer game for Houston a few years ago? They got beat 30-0. They got shut out, I think, at home.
Yes.
And the chances, I would love to see, but since 1980, how many times a team has even been within one or two scores when their quarterback throws three interceptions? That number has gone down dramatically. We talk about, you know, Case Keenum and all the, you know, gosh, you know what, yeah, he throws so many balls, he throws balls up for grabs, and, you know, he's so careless, and he has seven interceptions this year. I think the percentage is 1.5. His interception rate is 1.5%, which is seventh best in the league. So
Brees completed 72% of his passes. 72%.
If
you completed 50.
Yeah.
30 years ago, he's pretty good. He completes half his passes.
It's been an amazing paradigm change, and especially to hear coaches like Zimmer, who were around and at the time when it was but much more common to throw multiple interceptions. And you know, he's all railing about this one bad throw that Keenum made the other night, and he is fully experienced and immersed in the time when football was rampantly more likely to be turned over.
That could be. Now, there are two reasons for it, I would say, is one, you know, for this idea that there's just, we just have this dearth of quarterbacking. I'd say one reason is they play everybody. They want them to be good 8 games into their first season, you know, if mm-hmm. you know, they want Manuel or whatever his name is that they drafted to be able to play
Manuel, yeah.
Yeah, to play 10 games into his first season. But right. B, it is the standards we have for quarterbacking now are so much higher than they were, as I say, a generation and a half
and
ago.
And conclusions are drawn very early, and yes. Keenum, again, being a very good example. You know, he obviously not even drafted, so people had already decided he would never be an NFL starter, but he got a lot of playing time for a guy who was undrafted because of injuries and other reasons. And as we know from the way the offseason went, he was not considered anything close to being a potential starter, and the league had made up its mind on Case Keenum. And you know, I don't know exactly what's going to happen. I think the Vikings should keep him for next year at a starter's, you know, a market value starter salary. Somebody I would think is going to consider him a starter. And it took until his sixth NFL season. He's almost 30 years old, but it's rare that a guy who has that much playing time and has had, you know, in this era, gets that much playing time and had that little success, gets another full chance to become a starter. And lo and behold, it worked out.
I was looking up a piece today on the Vikings' number one draft choices since they last went to the playoffs, and because they, you know, they've had a few busts and some good picks too. But I ran into the Jahvid Best thing the first year afterwards. They made the trade for Jahvid Best. And I was seeing something about when they finally released Jahvid Best, and they were quoting you in there. Somebody writing for another source was quoting you having written on NFL Nation blog that a guy like this will never get taken in the first round again with his concussion history. Because the league is so much more paranoid about it for good reason right now. But that was, you know, I just ran across that, and that's a good point as to how...
Well, it's true. I mean, you think back to Jahvid Best. He played Cal, I think it was, and he had a play where he went up in the air to try to catch the ball. Somebody came underneath him, and he landed straight on his head and was knocked out on the
field. I think
field.
It was here, wasn't it, in college. In college, it happened that he got concussed at TCF Bank Stadium. I know
he had several of them, and there was one in particular. I don't know where it was, but somebody came up underneath him, and he just landed straight on his head and was knocked out, and immediately ruled out for the rest of the season. And that would be for good reason, you know, not just for political correctness or over safety. I mean, that is a career ending thing. Potentially to have a concussion so bad that you're knocked out, and that's your second or third concussion of the year, as I recall, and they had let him come back pretty quickly, and he's immediately ruled out indefinitely. And then, you know, he had a couple concussions in the NFL, and again the same thing happened. So that, you know, from a value standpoint, you plummet, and from a safety standpoint, it's the right thing to do. But you know, it's amazing. What was that, 2000? You said it was 2010?
2010.
Yeah, and so, like, amazing the extent to which the concussion issue and story have changed even since that point, which I know is 8 years ago, but it's very, very recently.
Just one quick thing. They flipped the fourth rounders in that they went down 4 spots and took Chris Cook, and then, which didn't turn out, but the guy they got in the fourth round was Everson Griffin.
That's another whole day story to itself is how they end up drafting him and what he was like his first few years and how no one would have imagined him to be a Pro Bowl pass rusher here 8 years later.
All right. Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Okay.
Talk to you next week, sir. Thanks. Kevin Seifert, NFL Nation blog for ESPN.
Here's Johnny Height with a sports update.
This sports update sponsored by La Quinta. How do you win on the road? Stay at La Quinta Inns and Suites. Enjoy stylish lobbies and exciting room renovations. Book now at LQ.com. Timberwolves in Houston this evening to play the Rockets, and as Mr. Reavers just pointed out, that's a bit of a late starter. They get underway at 8:30 tonight. Rockets will be without Trevor Ariza and Gerald Green. They're both suspended. They will have James Harden back, though, from injury. Probably play about 25 minutes, according to his coach. Reports have Vikings offensive coordinator Pat Shurmur, of course, going to coach the Giants when the season is over. Today, Shurmur talked to reporters about that, but he said he didn't want to talk about it. He said, quote, "It's not the time nor the place to be talking about that."
One of the things that Mr. Phil Mackey has been doing is trolling the Philadelphia Eagle diehard dude bros on Twitter, which is kind of funny, actually. I just got an email to the Beer Show page from a guy named Paul. It says, "We're coming for you. Hashtag Philly."
All right.
Does he have any idea that?
Apparently not.
Wow.
I'm gonna respond to him. I want to see what I'm going to get out of this.
You're kind of a Minnesota dude, bro. I don't know if I'd...
you want to hang out, watch the game?
Kind of a college knucklehead, backwards hat wearing
dummy fist. Tip back some Coors Lights, eat some buffalo cheese dip. Huh?
Where's Royce? I need to talk to him. Is he back yet?
Yeah, he's there. There you go, Pat.
What's up?
Royce, you had a brilliant idea, and now I'm working on one-liners to greet these morons as they get off the plane.
Yes.
Starting with... "Hey, who the hell are you supposed to be?" I think I'm going to go research every line that Don Rickles wrote, and I'm just going to use it on these idiots. Royce on Twitter suggested that he and I be the official greeters for the Super Bowl out at the airport.
Somebody asked whether I was returning, if I was returning to be part of a volunteer, and I decided, yeah, Kenny and I should be the main greeters.
Hey, nice wig, Elvis. Who told you that was a good look?
I started off with the gal coming up and saying, "Where's the train?" And I said, "Look up, you fat ass, and see where the..."
Read the signs.
The signs.
Hey, is that your daughter's shirt? That looks... Yeah. Oh, yeah, that looks great on you.
Medium.
Sure does, Mama.
Fake.
Kenny, it'd be wonderful.
Speaking of wigs, did you see the video of the high school basketball referee that had the pass that hit him in the back of the head, and his toupee went flying?
Oh, that's so
awesome. Johnny talked about that
so
yesterday.
Funny.
Poor guy.
How about the Rodney Dangerfield line? "Did you get a bowl of soup with that haircut?" I would just love to try that out on somebody.
I think it'll be good.
Be fun.
I'm all for it. Did I miss anything?
Yeah, I did a couple occupied. Stories. Nothing, okay, you know, good. Stuff you've already heard probably.
All right, Johnny. All right. Well, I'm sure you did a fine job.
Oh, okay. I'm done then?
Sure.
Okay, sure.
What a week.
Sure.
Is that the truth right there? Oh, my God.
The Ride with Royce.
Now, traffic.
Time for traffic and weather.
Would you actually do the weather for us?
Traffic and weather today.
Hey, Syncophant, what's the line on GL? It's close enough?
Close enough.
Yeah. I like Royce's line. What do we care?
State Fair T-shirt 2018.
The Diamond Awards being held tonight at Target Field. I got to think two reasons Twins Fest might be hurting a little bit this weekend. A, the just the absolute crazed attention to the Vikings. It's gonna be kind of difficult to get people thinking about other things. And B, we're not there this year, so. The 1500 ESPN will not be having our usual dynamic presence at Twins Fest.
And, you know, it always brings me back to easily one of my top three favorite moments ever in working in this radio station, in this building for the Hubbard for the last 10 years, was all of us so wide-eyed sitting at the Metrodome and Joe Soucheray looking around going, "Look at this dump."
As we started the Welcome to the Twins Fest.
Come on, folks, and meet the fellas.
Come on. I guess that's what...
So Joe, you know, you said that on the air, right?
We were out there so long that... So it had to be maybe 07, was it? When we had Joe Maurer was going to appear with us.
Oh, yeah.
And
I remember that.
There had to be 2,000 people sitting in those stands there waiting for Joe. So what was, that could have been, you know, he's MVP in 9, so it might have been 2010, something like that, the Twins Fest there. They were packing them in then, man. But
yeah, because you're right, because that would have been right before they moved it over to Target Field. Yeah.
Well, they moved it. Actually, it stayed at the Metrodome until they started tearing the Metrodome down. So when what years did they play? They played 14 and 15 in TCF Bank, right?
Right.
So it would have been. But I so
I remember that because I was there more as a spectator because I wasn't really working with you guys.
13 had to be the last year. So this is probably their fifth year at Target.
But that was when Joe Mauer was the king of the hill in this town.
Oh, man. And for damn good reason.
Absolutely.
Anyway, tonight, the Diamond Awards, Rick Stelmazik, who passed away recently at his battle with pancreatic cancer, was to receive the Good Guy Award from the Twin Cities chapter of the Baseball Writers Association of America. I think it's the Good Guy. There's two of them. There's a Distinguished Service and that one. But we wanted to give Stelly the Good Guy Award when he first left the organization.
Mm-hmm.
And Stelly was a little put off, and he just didn't want to do it. And then it did, you know, that first year, and then people spent a couple of years trying to talk him into it. And finally, when a couple other people received it, and then we went back to Stelly, and lo and behold, he had come up with pancreatic cancer while this was still going on, and everybody was very hopeful that he would make it to this to this event, but he of course passed away. He did get back this summer for the Tom Kelly statue unveiling and that thing, and that was great. But Stelly's wife, Kathy, will accept it for him tonight. And by all accounts, Kathy, when Stelly had his funeral in Chicago, south side of Chicago, there was only one eulogist, and it was Kathy. And they said she was fantastic.
Really?
I got that report from my friend Wong, who was as tight with Stelly as you could get.
Okay.
And also Big Herbie down here. I saw Herbie was down here for the Ken Urbeck for the fantasy camp. And I said, I heard. By the way, Herbie looks good.
That's what I heard you say.
I
heard you say
he's down 50.
What?
And I
wow, good for him.
Quite a bit. And I said, I hear Kathy was pretty good, and he. He gave me about 5 minutes on how excellent that was, the eulogy that she gave for this great character from the south side of Chicago. They got, I guess, the visitation or the wake or whatever it is, her and their son, their one child, 2.5 hours of shaking hands and taking
wow
from in every south side Polish person that you could find. I almost said something.
I know you
Polish,
did. I'm glad you self-edited
Polish
on the
person,
fly.
Yeah. It's just, you know, his life was, you talk about Rook being a guy who lived in one little area there, and Joe Stelly was, you know, the mom was, his wife's parents were kitty corner. His parents were a block down. His brothers, they all lived. That's the way it is in that steel mill part of south side of
they
Chicago.
They don't go anywhere, essentially.
No, they hang
so
out there.
So when you think of most beloved people in that franchise's history, is Stelly number one?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, and especially everybody who ever met him at Hubert's. You know, he used to walk into Hubert's, and there'd be a couple guys sitting there, and he'd say, hey, sprinkle the infield, which meant that used to be his thing. So everybody got a drink, sprinkle the infield.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Was his saying, and he was a hell of a guy. And Doja, I think Doja's getting most of the awards tonight, right? He's getting a few. And
Joe's getting one, right? Didn't Joe win?
Joe won the Upper Midwest.
That's it.
He hadn't won it for a few years, but he came. We got back to Joe winning it. Joe dominated the always difficult Upper Midwest Award because they started this in 1962 when they first gave these awards, the guys back then. So we went with Upper Midwest, okay. The Dakotas, Iowa,
yep.
Wisconsin,
sure.
Minnesota. We threw Wisconsin in. And then I think we might have thrown Nebraska in after a while. We let them in, maybe when they got in the Big Ten or something. I don't know. But some years it's been very difficult. And I think I give Jace Frederick credit with finding the relief pitcher from Iowa. Tony Watson?
Oh, that's right, yes.
Yeah, he's from Iowa, so he came up with him. and he got him in. I found our crowd didn't know that Jordan Zimmerman was a Wisconsin guy. Now, he was over on the other border, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But we got so I found Jordan Zimmerman one year because we were desperate when Joe went, you know, kind of when Joe
when he was having those injury problems, yeah.
Yeah, when he was having those injury problems. And then, you know, Neshek's won it twice, I think, and Brad Hand, I think Brad Hand won it last year, right? I think Brad Hand.
Oh, you're
Hand
right.
Won it
yes,
last year.
I think you're right.
Or is he win it? No, yeah, and then yeah, he won it last year. Now Joe won it again this year. So, so that's always the tough one to come up with. And then sometimes with the Twins, it's Rookie of the Year.
Sure,
you know, some guy had 42 at bats. You know?
Speaking of Neshek, he's a great follow on Twitter just because he's a baseball nerd like the rest of us, but. He threw out something. Johnny Height and I were talking about this maybe like a week or so ago, and he said there are five players left from the 2000 MLB draft that are still active.
Yes, I saw that.
And he's one of them. Along with Albert Pujols and a couple. I thought, oh my God, that's amazing.
I thought for sure he'd sign with a more established club, but he's going back to the Phillies with a nice deal.
Well, they're being kind of projected as a team that could sneak up a little bit this year. Because they've got some talent, so.
I think we have a red-hot Super Bowl story coming up, right?
We do. Any final thoughts? Okay. You got about 30 seconds. Any final thoughts?
Final thoughts from Florida?
Yeah.
Don't come down here. It's too damn cold. Stay home. Man, maybe later. By the way, check out the spring training schedule because it's earlier this year.
Yeah.
You come down at the end of February, you'll be able to get in any game you want to because the crowds aren't as big at the end of February. Don't wait till March. That's my advice. All right, gentlemen. See you Monday.
1500 ESPN presents 52 super stories leading up to the big game. Brought to you by Mr. Money Talk, Josh Arnold, where you always get straight talk, not sugar-coated advice. Here's Patrick Royce.
Number one on my list of the Grade 8 Super Bowls, you've been waiting, I know, was number 13, as well as the fifth and last Super Bowl played in Miami's historic Orange Bowl. Pittsburgh 35, Dallas 31 on January 21, 1979. I've always been of the opinion that the Steelers of the 70s were the greatest assemblage of NFL talent of my lifetime. And apparently the Pro Football Hall of Fame voters agree, since 11 of those Steelers are in Canton. The Cowboys were almost their equal in talent, even though they only have five of the players from the 1978 roster in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Tony Dorsett, Jackie Smith, Roger Staubach, Randy White, and Rayfield Wright. Cowboys also had Drew Pearson and Tony Hill as receivers, Ed Too Tall Jones at defensive end, Cliff Harris and Charlie Waters at the safeties, and all kinds of other guys. They had tremendous talent. This was the first season of the 16-game schedule in the NFL and also the first with a wild-card round in the playoffs. Dallas was 12-4 and beat Atlanta and the L.A. Rams in the playoffs. Pittsburgh was 14-2 and manhandled Denver and Houston Oilers. Dallas's Hollywood Henderson, the wonderfully talented, goofy linebacker, was the star attraction during the long week of pregame interviews. It was for this game that Hollywood questioned the intelligence of Pittsburgh quarterback Terry Bradshaw by saying he couldn't spell cat if you spotted him the C and the A. Dallas had a 14-7 lead early in the second quarter after linebacker Mike Hegman went 37 yards for a touchdown with a Bradshaw fumble.
Fumble! Bradshaw, oh, he had going in with it. Number 58, Mike Hegman.
The Steelers came right back when Bradshaw threw 10 yards over the middle to John Stallworth, and Stallworth cut through a couple of tackles and completed a 75-yard touchdown. Then in the third quarter, came the infamous Jackie Smith drop that would have tied the game at 21.
Rodgers back to throw, has a man open in the end zone, caught, touchdown, drop, just in the end zone, Jackie Smith all by himself. Oh, bless his heart, he's got to be the sickest man in America.
After that, there was a questionable interference that led to a 22-yard touchdown run by Franco Harris, a short kick that Randy White tried to field while wearing a cast on his hand, and that led to another touchdown. 35-17 with 6:51 left. Cowboys came back with two touchdowns to make it 35-31. They had a lot of bad breaks that day. Cowboys collection that was taking on what I consider to be the best team ever. Also a bad break for the sports books in Vegas. The game opened with Pittsburgh as a 3.5-point favorite, a bunch of Steelers' money rolled in, moving the line to 4.5. Then the Cowboys' money came rolling in, and the game settled at 4. The early Pittsburgh bettors were paid, the later Cowboys bettors were paid, and everyone else got a push, meaning the sports books were middled for tens of millions, and they have since referred to January 21, 1979 in Las Vegas as Black Sunday.
52 Super Stories continues next week. Brought to you by Mr. Money Talk, Josh Arnold, where you always get straight talk, not sugar-coated advice. And for more details on Super Bowl 52 coming to the Twin Cities in 2018, sign up for the host committee email at mmsuperbowl.com.
Mike Rowe here with a few thoughts on my favorite sweatshirt, a classic zip-up hoodie that used to be navy blue but has since faded to what the fashionistas call a distressed indigo. It's 13 years old, soft as a flannel bathrobe, and after a few hundred dirty jobs, demonstrably and undeniably indestructible. This is the kind of sweatshirt girlfriends like to permanently borrow, but I've held on to this one because I got it from American Giant. American Giant makes all their stuff right here in the USA, so they can control every link in their own supply chain. That matters, because when you buy American Giant, you not only get great quality, you create jobs for people in factory towns all over the country. No pressure, but if you give a damn about the business of making things in America, you got to support the companies who are doing it right. Go to American-Giant.com/Mike to get 20% off your first order. That's American-Giant.com/Mike.